Many of you may recall that I helped popularize keto. And in fact, in 2017, I wrote a book called Fat for Fuel, which, when it was released, was the number one book sold in the United States overall, not just in so obscure category on Amazon. And many, many people improved, including myself, by following the principles in here. And I believed at the time that fat was the best fuel that you could use to generate energy in your body. And I'm not dismissing the fact that many people improved, including myself, but many people also had challenges following the low carb diet, especially for a long time. And this information I've just learned relatively recently, within the last year, as a result of studying the work of Ray Peet, who sadly passed away in May and Thanksgiving of 2022. But provided us with an important legacy of work that I think could help us understand how the body works even better. So one of the things that he helped me understand is that your body needs sugar. It absolutely needs sugar. If you don't get it, you will be dead shortly, and because you'll be in a hypoglycemic coma. That's what happens. You have to have sugar. Your brain requires it. It's absolutely imperative. So thankfully, your body has a rescue system when your sugar gets too low. Now, your body only has a limited store of carbohydrates or sugar in the form of glycogen, typically in the liver. You have it in your muscles too, but only your muscles can use that. But systemically, it's the one in your liver that makes the difference. So you only have enough for about a day, maybe two, some people possibly three, but it's typically within 1 and 2 days. So when you exhaust that, your body has to make sugar. So the question becomes, how does your body make sugar? I did not know this. I did not appreciate it. I did not realize this was the mechanism. But now I share the mechanism with you. You might be as equally shocked as I will. It makes a hormone that you all have heard of called cortisol. Now, cortisol is in a group of hormones called the glucocorticoids. And it's just what it says. The gluco means glucose. Cortico means comes from the adrenal cortex, and oid means as a steroid. So the primary purpose, and if you study cortisol and look at up its functions, you'll find that it's designed for glucose homeostasis, but it does far more than that. It's actually a rescue hormone that your body has, because if your blood sugar gets too low, you're going to die. So thankfully, we have cortisol, and when it's activated, it will send signals to your body to break down your muscles, your bones, and brain. Why? Because it needs amino acids, which it's going to use as the raw material to make glucose in a process called gluconeogenesis in your liver. So thankfully, you have this rescue pathway to increase your sugar. And it's very rare where someone ever dies from a hypoglycemic coma because their cortisol level rescues them, but they will die prematurely from the effects of elevated cortisol. Chronic inflammation, because that's its other purpose. And many people, and clinicians included, believe that that's its primary purpose, but it's not. And in fact, I've been a participant in many longevity groups and have listened to many of the experts. And personally, it may be my memory is getting not as good as it used to be, but I don't ever recall anyone highlighting the fact that elevated cortisol level is a primary way that you're going to age. It is literally the primary aging hormone. So if you are interested in living longer and living healthy, then you're going to want to lower your cortisol levels. And in fact, a study was published just recently in May of 2023 that was done to show what the differences are between a low carb, high fat diet, which I was promoting and recommending, and a low fat, high carb diet. Well, wouldn't you know, both of those groups had a difference of 30% changes in their mortality rate. One, the low carb, high fat diet increased their mortality rate by 30%, whereas the converse, the low fat, high carb, actually decreased it. So this, to me, this is I encountered this study not too long after I started to understand this information. And to me, it was supporting the evidence. This is something I should consider. And you may want to consider too. You may dismiss it. And if you're doing great now, that's fine. But it's something to consider. So it seems like it would be prudent to not activate cortisol continuously and accelerate the aging process. But here's the caution. Here's the danger. Here's the concern. Many people have tried high carbohydrates and they failed miserably in many cases. Why? I want to tell you one of the primary reasons that this is likely the case. Because they didn't understand that your body has a metabolic switch. In many ways, a switch is a switch very similar to the one on a railroad track, where the train comes along and then you throw the switch and it goes down a different track. It can only go down one track at a time. The train can't split itself in two and go down both tracks. So there's a switch. And actually, this switch has a name. It's called the Randall cycle. This essentially describes a process where your tissue can only burn one fuel at a time. It can't burn fat and glucose at the same time. And glucose is the same as a synonym for sugar. So the threshold appears to be, and this is different for different people, but it's about 30%. And what do I mean? If your fat level is above 30%, then you're not going to be able to take that sugar, that glucose, and run it through your mitochondria, which is a small organelle within almost every blood cell in your body, except for the red blood cells, that is produces cellular energy in the form of ATP. That's the way, that's really one of the primary differences between higher order organisms and lower order ones like bacteria. They don't have mitochondria, we do. And it's very efficient at creating energy. However, if your fat level is over, the fat content, the percentage of fat that you're consuming in your diet is over 30%, then this sugar is backed up and it can't go through the mitochondria. It has an alternate source. That alternate source is called glycolysis and it essentially is very inefficient. You can take one molecule of glucose and you only make two ATP. That's it. And it also doesn't require oxygen. And then, so we think, well, that's great. It's not going to create many reactive oxygen species, but that's actually quite to the contrary, because it's so inefficient, it's going to create a lot more reactive oxygen species. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So if your fat level is under 30%, and in some cases where there's some pretty severe metabolic inflexibility, like obesity or diabetes, that level may have to decrease to 15 to 20%, which is pretty extreme. That's a pretty low fat diet. I don't think it ever really should go under 10%, but the lower you can go, the better that you can tolerate. Usually meal or diets under 10% fat are going to be very hard to tolerate. It's just not doable for most people. But the threshold appears to be 30%. If you have less than 30% of your total calories as fat, then the glucose that you're ingesting can be used efficiently in your mitochondria. And we'll talk, there's some different ways that you can burn that even within the mitochondria if your fat is less than 30%. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But that's the primary principle, is you've got to get the fat level right first and foremost. And then you can hope that you're going to have a chance of burning this. Now, again, that could be as little as 15% if you're obese or diabetic. So you'd have to play with that. And I think that's one of the reasons why most people who try introducing the carbohydrates run into problems. The other is you don't want to do this quickly. If you've been in low carb, high fat for years and you're doing okay, fine. Maybe you don't want to consider this at all. But if you're having problems or you want to consider it, then maybe make the transition slowly. I was taking anywhere between 50 and 100 grams of carbohydrates for many years. And I switched to about almost 500 grams of carbohydrates over a few months. And it seems to be doing pretty well for me. But just let your body tell you what's good for you and use that to guide your process through the system. So that's the first step. Get your fat level at least below 30% fat percent. You can't just use any old carbohydrates. So what type of carbohydrates are there? Well, roughly, as most of you know, breaks down into two different types, simple and complex. And we've been taught for years, decades, even longer, that the simple carbohydrates, simple sugars, are not good for you. They're dangerous, and that's the core of why almost everyone gets sick. Well, that's not true. And then there's the complex carbs, which supposedly were much healthier. And it actually seems to be reverse. The simple carbs be a little better because they're broken down to sugar more quickly. And let me explain this, why this I'm presenting this ostensibly appears to be confusing information, is because when you have carbohydrates linked and digested easily in your stomach, that will serve as fuel for the trillions of bacteria that are in your large intestine. You know, the bacteria in our body outnumber our cells 10 to 1. So when this fuel, undigested fuel, the complex carbohydrates like starches, specifically starches, get down there and you haven't used them, you haven't liberated the glucose so you can burn them in your mitochondria, the bacteria will take care of them. And the problem with that is that they feed on that fuel, they reproduce, they multiply, and they die. And there's a certain percentage, it varies between everyone, but of gram-negative bacteria in your intestine that when they die, within their cell wall, they have something called endotoxin. It's also called lipopolysaccharide. And the endotoxin causes lots of complications. It increases, it can lead, actually can kill you from sepsis, but it increases leaky gut, increases inflammation, cortisol raising, serotonin. It just is a whole panoply of bad news that happens when you have increased endotoxin. And the primary way you create it is eating these complex carbs that aren't digested well. So you have to be really, really careful on this. And this is another way that people who try to increase their carbs run into problems because they're eating the wrong type of carbs. So what are the right types? It appears that the healthiest carbohydrates you can eat, because they are whole foods and specifically whole ripe, and I definitely emphasize ripe fruits, because they are just broken down to sugar real quickly. And they're also loaded with other micronutrients like potassium. You know, you can do not get enough potassium in your diet. It doesn't mean you need to take a potassium supplement. It means you need to increase it in the food that you're eating. And one of the best ways to get it is through fruit and vitamin C and other nutrients. So if you're eating whole foods, unprocessed foods, you're going to have a balanced diet, and you're going to get all the nutrients that we didn't even know about to improve your health. The other types, so that's probably the ideal and the one you should strive for. The other starch that you can use would be well-cooked starches. Things like white rice, not brown rice, but white rice, and potatoes that are boiled. Typically, small red potatoes work the best. Sweet potatoes probably want to avoid because they're high in not only the starches, but oxalates. And so when you, even regular potatoes are, but when you cook them and you boil them in water, it's a little better. So that those are two relatively inexpensive sources, forms of carbs. And I know many people struggle nowadays with finances and how am I going to afford all this? Well, I'm hoping to describe a process where you can obtain these calories relatively inexpensively and have magnificent health. Some other fine tunes that are important to consider. And one, if you're interested in optimizing your health and improving your body's ability to increase ATP, specifically your mitochondria. And this is a concept called forward electron transfer. Now, if you are young and healthy and without any major issues, health issues going on, then this is probably what's happening. This is at one point in life, almost everyone was doing it, but very few people are doing this now, at least not close to 100%. So to understand how this works, I want to describe mitochondria. And many of you may say, oh, shudder and say, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to look at this. Well, you don't have to, but if you really want to understand this, I think you'll benefit from it. I'm trying to simplify it as much as possible. So you see on the screen, a illustration that's two-dimensional. These mitochondria are three-dimensional, and it looks, in reality, they look a lot different than this. But all that you need to understand now is the concept that this illustration portrays. So the two purple dots, set of purple dots, that's a membrane. So the one on the top is the outer mitochondrial membrane. The one on the bottom is the inner mitochondrial membrane. And the red, green, blue, and two green figures there are what It's called complexes, which is a collection of proteins that are embedded in the mitochondrial membrane. And the purpose of these complexes is this is how your body takes the fuel that you eat. And the fuel is primarily, it's not protein. You need protein, but that's pretty much for your structure. But the fuel that you burn to create energy in the form of ATP is primarily two macronutrients. One is fat, the other is sugar or glucose. It's converted to glucose. So the food that you're eating, the glucose or the fat, has electrons. It donates electrons. And the electrons are a form of energy that your body uses to create the ATP. Now, those electrons are shuttled through these complexes. And they typically go from left to right, from complex one to complex five, which is also called ATP synthetase, which does the actual job of putting the ATP together. Now, when things are flowing well, and the electrons are going forward from complex one to five, you have an ideal scenario. And this is what I did not know until just very recently, that the reactive oxygen species, sometimes called ROS, which almost everyone understands and realizes that this is one of the main challenges we have for life and health and produces disease, are these ROS molecules. Well, I didn't realize that when your mitochondria are working well, that it's less than 0.1%. In other words, 99.9% efficient, only 0.1% exhaust. And the exhaust is in the form of these ROS. So and those little red circles with the negative, and those are illustrations of an electron that just flows and they're passed along. And what happens is ultimately they're passed to oxygen, which is the ultimate electron acceptor. And when you're doing this, it's interesting, you're actually able to pass the electrons to oxygen, so it's in an acceptable state. And there's the other element of this, aside from the electrons passing, is their protons are produced, and they're deposited in the mitochondrial matrix. And then the complex five takes those protons with an oxygen that has the electrons attached to it, and it makes water. It doesn't just make any water. It makes metabolic water, also known as deuterium depleted water. And deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen that's very large and cumbersome, and it kind of screws up the ATP synthase. So it's really the healthiest form of water you could possibly get, deuterium depleted water. And your body makes it all the time. And it also makes carbon dioxide when you do this. And carbon dioxide is actually healthy. And like many people are confused on that, many people are confused and thinking that carbon dioxide is a poisonous byproduct. No, it's carbon monoxide that kills you. It's not carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, you need levels. And this is why people who live at altitude tend to have better health outcomes, because the partial pressure of oxygen is lower and their carbon dioxide increases. So, but then it also makes the water and the carbon dioxide, and then the ATP. Now, interestingly, you can see there's cofactors in the complexes to help make the ATP. And the two big ones are NAD plus. This is huge. This is beyond huge. And I know this is a little complicated, but just understand that when the NAD plus, that means a plus means it's oxidized. Okay. And let me shift to the next slide to go over this, because this NAD molecule is one of the most important molecules in your body. It's almost the equivalent of ATP in some respects. Pretty much almost every action in your body that's required needs ATP, but it's almost similar with NAD. NAD plus is a cofactor in over 500 reactions in your body. And here's the one of the key ones is in the creation of ATP. If you don't have NAD plus, you're not going to make ATP. And in fact, it's such a strong statement that they're essentially equivalent. Your NAD plus levels is almost equal to your ATP levels. So the moment your NAD plus goes down, you are in deep weeds. So NAD plus is oxidized, once it receives an electron, it gets reduced, and that is called NADH. And there's an equilibrium there, depending on what the redox reactions in your body are exposed to. But essentially, the key point here to understand is that you need NAD+. Okay, now we're going to skip to something that's called reverse electron transfer, also known as reductive stress. Most all of us have heard of oxidative stress, where you create most of the damage. But actually, what seems to be causing most of the oxidative stress is reductive stress. And this is a concept that is virtually unknown within the health community. Virtually no one understands this, but you will once you review this slide and meditate on it a bit. It's pretty straightforward once you've got the basics down. So what happens in reverse electron transfer is that you've got these cofactors, specifically in complex 1 and 2 of NAD and FAD, plus. These are, remember, the plus means it's oxidized. Now, when you have a surplus of electrons coming in there, they turn those complexes into the reduced form. With NAD, it would be NADH, and with FAD plus, it would be FADH. And once those cofactors are reduced, you prevent a barrier, a block, and those electrons do not shuttle forward like in the last slide. They're going backwards. They're going reverse. And that reverse direction causes profoundly serious inabilities to create ATP. But I'm going to show you, don't get too concerned, because I'm going to show you how you can solve this. It's really simple and inexpensive, inexpensive. So, but this is what's happening to most people. Now, here's the bottom line on this, the one that will have you shaking your head and saying, I cannot believe this. Well, when this happens, the reactive oxygen species are 3 to 4%, not 0.1%. That's 30 to 40 times greater. 30 to 40 times more reactive oxygen species because it's going the wrong way. So how can you turn this around? There's three simple things you can do. One, you can see those little tails between the purple and in the mitochondrial membrane. Those are fatty acids. They represent a fatty acid. And when you are eating more linoleic acid or seed oils or omega-6 in your diet, those fats get embedded in the membrane. And that membrane, you have PUFA in there, absolutely is probably the leading cause of reductive stress. It's the primary cause of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, is PUFA. And this is the way it causes it, folks. There's other ways, but the embedding in that membrane is going to radically increase oxidative stress and decrease ATP production. And it also does it in other ways too, because the linoleic acid can be broken down and metabolized and create additional oxidative species that's even worse than these in some ways. All right. So the way that you can solve it is get your seed oil as low as I talked about earlier in other presentations. It's just lower the seed oils because that is so important. You can also increase NAD plus through a supplement called niacinamide, and you can use methylene blue. The niacinamide will increase the NAD and turn it to NAD plus. And the methylene blue is a very potent oxidant so that it takes the NADH and it converts that to NAD plus. And niacinamide essentially is raw material that your body makes new NAD plus by fueling up the rate limiting bottleneck enzyme in the NAD salvage pathway called NAMPT. So there are two different mechanisms of how they work. And let me just show you a little study that I found last year. I've been using niacinamide as a supplement. Niacinamide is also, this sub study you see is called nicotinamide, but that's the scientific term for it. But the scientists, after a while, when lay people were reading it, they were confusing nicotinamide with nicotine. So the researchers changed the name to niacinamide. So that's the same. They're the same darn molecule. So I was taking niacinamide. I've been doing it about 2 years now because it was very obvious to me, and I've done interviews with molecular biologists who understand and appreciate this, that niacinamide was the way to increase your NAD+. And it turns out I was right on steroids with that because a study was published last year. This was done on rats, though. And it showed that niacinamide, the dose that I recommended was using, which is about 2 milligrams per kilogram per day, in divided doses, was able to increase NAD plus in these rats by 32-fold. That's 3,200%. It obliterated the obesity. I think that some of these rats lost half of their body weight, and it radically improved their glucose control. So this is a landmark study. It was just published in September of 2022, late last year, and it's available free online. You can see the whole thing. You don't have to pay for it if you want to look at the details. Now, niacinamide doesn't only reduce obesity. it actually deactivates the cortisol. Remember, you talked about cortisol was one of the primary reasons why we wanted to shift to this type, because at least consider shifting to this type of approach, is reducing the cortisol. Well, niacinamide, because it makes NAD+, actually deactivates your cortisol to the inactive cortisone. And it helps treat and prevent cancer by reducing that reductive stress we just talked about. Now, the optimal dose is about 50 milligrams three times a day. The sad reality is that there, at least at this point, to the time of recording this video, there are no companies that make 50 milligram niacinamide tablets. The smallest you can find typically is 500, there are many that are 1,000 milligrams. That dose is way, way too high, will actually cause complications. There is a Goldilocks sweet dose in here, and it's about 50 milligrams three times a day for most people. If you're a little bigger, it might be more, or if you're more active, you can maybe do it four times a day. And you don't want to take it all at once. You want to split it up evenly throughout the day. So as soon as you get up, right before you go to bed, and once or twice in between. And the point I wanted to make here too, I said, well, then how are you going to do it? Well, you can get niacinamide powder, relatively inexpensive, maybe $10 for a half a pound, and would last you or your family a year or longer at this dosage rate, because you don't need much. Now, that way you're going to measure that. How are you going to measure it? You could get a milligram scale. That's one way. But a simpler way is just to get a stainless steel 1/64 teaspoon, 1/64 of a teaspoon, and use that as a powder. I like to keep the niacinamide I'm not using in the freezer to keep it more fresher, essentially, and non-damaged. And then when I do use, I just leave out maybe a month's supply, and I use that and go through that, and then I refill the bottle. But if you want to be even more convenient, our company has actually decided to make a niacinamide tablet. It's going to be 50 milligrams. So it's going to be out at the end of July. And that is something you consider, but you can just as easily do the powder. So you can do that now. So you can use methylene blue, and it's a drug that was discovered in 1876. And that wasn't its original purpose. It was designed as a dye. It actually dyes blue jeans blue, because it's a dye. And if you use it, you have to be really, really careful, because it will stain just about anything you get in contact with it. And fortunately, you can use vitamin C or ascorbic acid to reduce it. And when it's reduced, it's colorless. But when it's oxidized, it's blue. So its primary purpose is it essentially eliminates the reductive stress we just talked about in the last slide. It just obliterates it. As a secondary result of that, you can increase your ATP levels by 30%. 30%. So anyone who's tired, fatigued, notice a pretty dramatic and remarkable improvement. And you know that if you have reductive stress, you're making 30 to 40 times more reactive oxygen species. So oxidative stress is through the roof. And this is one of the ways that it help is a primary, important, fundamental, foundational treatment for preventing or treating just about every degenerative disease we're exposed to: obesity, cancer, dementia, cardiovascular disease, strokes. You know, these are the things that it's good for. So can anyone use that methylene blue? Pretty much the only caution, the only described caution in using it, is that if you are taking an SSRI for depression or any other reason, then methylene blue has been described as a monoamine oxidase A inhibitor. What the heck does that mean? It means that the primary way that you metabolize serotonin in your body is through this MAO enzyme. And methylene blue actually inhibits that, which means that it will allow the levels of serotonin to increase in your body. And if you're taking an SSRI, that's exactly what that does. It increases serotonin. So you could develop something like serotonin syndrome, and that could be very dangerous. So if you're on an SSRI, the best thing to do, the absolute best strategy, is to wean yourself off with a knowledgeable clinician. Ideally, you don't want to be on an SSRI when you're taking this. So what is the dose? The dose is about 15 milligrams. Not that much. Maybe 10 to 15 milligrams is a sweet spot in there. And you only take it once a day. Again, be really, really careful and cautious, because if you're using the powder and you scoop up 10 milligrams, almost invariably, you're going to spill a very tiny, essentially piece of dust particle on your counter, and you'll stay, or your table, and you'll stain it. So ideally, it's best to measure this over a stainless steel sink, so it doesn't stain. And anything that is dropped on the sink, you could just rinse down the drain. So 15 milligrams is a really, really tiny scoop. You could use a milligram scale to weigh this, or you can just simply get a purchase a stainless steel micro scoop from this company that I listed on the slide there that will give you this for about $10 with shipping or so. And then you have it and can easily measure this out and use it to receive all the benefits.